You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Emma Barnett. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Morocco is Africa's most stable state, but is it about to crack? We speak to a journalist in the region to find out more. Also ahead, as the deadline looms for political parties to register in Russia, we'll ask if this will really change the game.
That many of these parties have come out of the blue. They've been created almost overnight. No one has really heard of them. And frankly, some of them are deeply obscure.
And we'll be talking design with our design editor, Hugo MacDonald. On today's agenda, the menswear shows at Paris Fashion Week. And are technology companies in Silicon Valley going retro and bringing back manufacturing to the USA? Well, Google are. We'll be discussing the pros and cons later in the show. All that, plus we'll play some music too. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the latest headlines with Roger Crisp.
The US Supreme Court has made a historic ruling in favor of President Barack Obama's signature healthcare reform law. The result drew the expected rounds of cheers and criticism just minutes after the verdict was made public. Supporters said the ruling was a step forward in healthcare reform in the United States.
I've seen the suffering of people that have to worry about not having health care. And it's not humane, and I'm so glad our country is finally on the path to sanity when it comes to health care.
We feel that the health care reform law has only been a good thing to help the rising cost of health care, to help us all get towards a better health care system. And if it had been overturned, that would have been putting us back to square one.
Among the provisions of the law, often derided as Obamacare by the president's Republican opponents, is the requirement that all Americans purchase a government-sponsored insurance plan. Opponents of the law see it as an unwelcome infringement of big government into citizens' lives, as well as a burden on the business community and the overall American economy. The law represents the biggest revamp in 50 years to the $2.6 trillion U.S. healthcare system. Eurozone leaders are meeting in Brussels today in a summit which could decide the future of the euro. Draft conclusions of the EU leaders' summit showed that European Union leaders will ask the bloc's top four officials to develop the stages they've identified so far into a detailed and time-specific roadmap that will result in a genuine economic and monetary union. Finland's Europe Minister said today that Europe should prepare to live in a state of crisis for the rest of the decade, but that a stronger and more resilient continent will eventually emerge. Turkey's state-run news agency says that military vehicles carrying missile batteries have been sent to various points along the Syrian border. International calls for Turkey to show restraint after one of its military aircraft was shot down by Syria have gone unheeded. The Turkish government said that the attack would not go unpunished. In more news from the region, Russia is reported to be supporting Kofi Annan's six-point peace plan for Syria. The plan calls for a national unity government to bring about political change and will be discussed at a special meeting of the UN Action Group on Syria in Geneva on Saturday. Shares in Barclays Bank fell 15.5% today, their biggest one-day fall since 2009, as authorities prepared to investigate the bank's bosses. Barclays was fined £290 million by US and British authorities yesterday after investigations found that the bank had tried to manipulate key market interest rates. British Prime Minister David Cameron has called for a serious inquiry.
Well, look, this is a scandal. It's extremely serious. They've paid a very large fine, and quite rightly. But frankly, the Barclays management team have some big questions to answer. How did this happen? Who was responsible? Who's going to be held accountable for it?
French carmaker PSA Peugeot Citroën has launched its high-range DS line in China today, expecting sales in the world's largest car market to continue boosting its global output. Grégoire Olivier of PSA Peugeot Citroën said the company is still expecting high growth in China.
What makes ourselves confident, and you still have only 50 cars per 1,000 inhabitants in China, and the fact that the Chinese infrastructure is being built very fast. Now, it's true that the very large cities see their market in percentage go down, but you have a huge growth within the interior of China going west, so we are very confident this growth will continue.
And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Roger. It's 5 minutes past the hour.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Hong Kong, és Tokyo. Ez a Monocle 24.
Velkommen til Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, Μπρούσε, Monocle 24.
Lontosta käsin, tämä on Monocle 24.
Londonbo, ez a Monocle 24.
Londodan, burası Monocle 24.
Londonist, sinä Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que ninatteiro no a Monocle 24.
Αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24, tagat ja.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London. Now, after 2 years of uncertainty and months of heated debate, the verdict on the Affordable Care Act, dubbed by its opposition as Obamacare, is in. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court ruled a few hours ago that the Act, including the individual mandate which requires that virtually all Americans purchase health insurance, is constitutional, handing the president a political victory. The Affordable Care Act will provide health insurance to more than 30 million previously uninsured Americans and to slow down escalating medical costs. It constitutes the US healthcare system's biggest overhaul in nearly 50 years. While people like Wisconsin's Governor Scott Walker have been very vocal in their opposition to the Affordable Care Act, it hasn't all been criticism. Professor Dave Fagman is the director of the University of California Hastings Consortium on Law, Science and Health Policy and has written widely on why he thinks the Act will be upheld in the Supreme Court and spoke to Monocle a little earlier.
I'm a constitutional law professor first and foremost, and as a plain constitutional matter, I think most constitutional scholars agree that it was never really a close question in terms of precedent or in terms of the constitutional text. In fact, I think it went forward, the Affordable Care Act went forward at first, and nobody really thought that there would be a substantial or serious challenge under the Constitution to it. And in fact, when the complaints were first raised that somehow this would fail under the applicable provision, which is the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, many people actually said it was fairly laughable, and it was really just over time that argument seemed to get some traction. But I have to say, from an academic constitutional standpoint, it is somewhat remarkable that this thing has gotten as far as it's gotten.
But joining us now on the line is our Washington correspondent, Sasha Issenberg.
Hi, how are you?
Hello, Sasha. Thanks for joining us. So is this it? Does this mean the health overhaul law is in place for good?
Well, if you listen to Republicans, including Mitt Romney, they still want to keep fighting. So it'll mean that happens legislatively. There's been this talk about repealing and or replacing Obamacare with, first it would be a vote basically to undo the law, and then it would be what Republicans describe as sort of reintroducing some of the popular provisions that they deem uncontroversial, like some of the restraints on costs and insurance regulations about pre-existing conditions and allowing people up to age 26 to stay on their parents' plans. I think that there are a couple questions. Obviously, the big one is what happens in November. There may be some symbolic votes in the House of Representatives, but Democrats continue to control the Senate, and there's no way that they could pass something over Obama's veto. So it would require almost certainly a Romney victory and Republicans not only to hold their margin in the House, but to win back the Senate, which is plausible. And then they'd have to decide that they want to make that the first big item on their legislative agenda in 2013. And I think that even if Republicans return to control in Washington, I'm not sure that would be a strategic calculation that everybody was on board with.
I mean, I think what's interesting is some commentators were already saying, in a weird kind of way, this is a victory for Romney because it gives him something really strong to galvanize his campaign against Obama. Would you agree with that?
I mean, there's been this sort of thinking that, you know, which obviously can't scientifically, physically be true, but either judgment by the Supreme Court would be good and bad for both sides simultaneously. I mean, for Romney, the upside is yes. Now, you know, Romney's always been looking for opportunities to prove to Republicans and conservatives that he's a champion of their interests. And in this area, he's a particularly flawed champion for them because his bill in Massachusetts has been something of a model. So coming out as he did immediately after the decision this morning behind a podium that says repeal and replace Obamacare and saying that he's intent on fighting this was a way of winning over conservatives and showing that he has a little bit of fight in him. The problem is that there's, you know, a sort of harder point of entry rhetorically in going after this to the broader electorate. And I think the Democrats, including the White House and the campaign, are counting on some idea that there's a sort of fatigue on the part of the electorate. We went through a year and a half of legislative battle over this. Now we've gone through another almost 2 years of legal battles over this. You know, the question is, do Americans want to go through another, 6-month period of campaigning on the subject and whatever happens after that? And Romney's made clear that at almost every juncture, he'd rather be talking about economic growth and jobs. And we'll see in a couple of months whether he's still such a fighter on health care.
When do you think Americans will see any sort of big change?
I mean, we've already seen some small changes on some of the insurance reforms. Some of them have been coming into law, and in many cases, insurance companies trying to get out in front of what they, you know will be changes in the law have been adjusting their own policies. So that there are, and there have been indications that already some costs have come down because of that. States have to implement many of the provisions of this bill. Some of them have been dragging their feet with the idea that the law might be rejected, and they didn't want to sort of invest the time and resources to doing that. But I think that, there'll be fewer openings for states to slow down, and we'll probably, regardless of where their leaders, feel the ideal policy will be, they'll sort of feel compelled to start enforcing it.
Okay, thank you so much for that insight. That was Monocle's Sasha Isenberg. You're listening to Midori House, and we'll be back with an update from Russia after this.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture. From the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
It's that time of year again when City Hall officials dab their concerned brows and mayors worry if they've raised their game enough to even get a mention. That's because Monocle's bumper annual quality of life survey is hitting newsstands with its ranking of the top 25 cities to call home. Pick up your copy to see whether your town is a magnetic metropolis or a city on the slide. The July-August double issue comes with many more surprises too. From 5 cities that are never going to win on metrics, but which we love anyway, to 10 surprising leaders you should know, to 50 things to improve your life. And our editors have been busy rounding up many more reports.
This month we sit down with the Mayor of New York, Mike Bloomberg. We showcase some of the best concierges from New York to London, and we visit a suburb with style, Wannsee, in Berlin.
In the business section this month, we look at the business of logistics, meeting the delivery people, couriers and security services that make moving things around dense urban environments possible and even pleasurable. We'll also be getting on our bikes when we take management tips from the woman who spearheaded the two-wheeled revolution in Montreal.
You'll find all this and more in the July-August issue of Monocle that's on newsstands now.
You're listening to Midori House. The recent elections in Russia exposed a growing movement of middle-class voters. Many of the Muscovites, who, young enough to have no concrete recollection of communism, have found a political voice. Their protests led to the then-president Dmitry Medvedev to introduce a new law allowing for the creation of new political parties. This weekend sees the deadline for these parties to register themselves. So who are the new faces of Russian politics? A little earlier, Monocle's Emma Nelson spoke with Andrew Osborne, a journalist who's spent many years covering events in Russia, to get the latest.
Just explain to us very briefly the background of this new law that Medvedev implemented.
Yes, well, this is all about really the protests, as you said, which were unprecedented. Tens of thousands of people taking to the streets of Moscow and St. Petersburg in the wake of the parliamentary election in December. The main allegation there was that it was fraud-ridden. That's what sparked these protests. So the Kremlin, panicking, not used to this kind of reaction, decided to come out with this law. And really, this law is all about trying to create the impression that Russia is a multi-party democracy. Because, of course, we shouldn't remember that, yes, OK, the Soviet Union, long gone, 1991, but still today, Russia is de facto a one-party state. The United Russia Party, that's the party that Vladimir Putin led, Dmitry Medvedev was part of. So this is all about trying to placate these protests.
So on the one hand, we are seeing a flowering of political parties. Who is coming to the fore, ostensibly? We'll move on to what it really means in a moment, but who's actually putting their hands up above the party, you know, and saying, you know, vote for me?
That's right. I mean, up to now, the Russian political system, as I said, has been dominated by one party. There have been a couple of others. But with this law, we've actually seen more than 20 parties register. This could go up to 30 by the deadline. That's July the 1st. The interesting thing about this is, though, that many of these parties have come out of the blue. They've been created almost overnight. No one has really heard of them. And frankly, some of them are deeply obscure. There are nationalist parties. There are parties devoted to city dwellers. So there's a multitude of these parties. And there are so many, in fact, and they're so obscure that, of course, this is Russia, so there's always a conspiracy theories. So the theory is that the Kremlin has deliberately kind of opened this Pandora's box to flood the political market with all these parties so that people will be confused and that this will kind of undermine the efforts of the main anti-Kremlin opposition.
I think some critics have said that the aim is the creation of 100 new parties, each of which is no higher than 2 centimetres tall. How intelligent, though, is this new breed of Russian voter who can possibly see through this?
I think Russian voters are very astute indeed. I mean, essentially what's happened is that under Putin, who of course became president in 2000, and in March won an election, which will see him remain president for another 6 years, there was essentially a deal between the Russian people, which was, listen, you provide us with stability and rising living standards, which was easy because the price of oil was skyrocketing. We will support you. That kind of social contract, if you like, has begun to fray around the edges. And that's why the Kremlin now is scrambling to please people. So voters are not stupid, but they recognise the system has not really changed massively. This does remain a one-party state. So no matter how smart they are, their ability to change is quite limited. And that's why we're seeing so many of these people continue to come out onto the streets.
You mentioned a moment ago that there's a creation of a nationalist party, and its aim, I understand, is to unite Russia, Ukraine and Belarus. There's always this argument that communism, however bad it was effective because it had one central point of control which united an enormous amount of space. Is this issue of space going to be the big... Is this the great sticking point when trying to create sustainable and genuine political parties?
It is a factor, certainly. But we shouldn't forget Russia, already the largest country in the world by territory, one-fifth of the Earth's surface, former Soviet Union was one-sixth. But this idea that the Nationalist Party is pushing to unite with Ukraine and Belarus, which share a lot in common culturally and historically, it's certainly a very popular one with a lot of people across Russia. There's still a lot of nostalgia for the Soviet Union. So a lot of people hark after that. It's not so much about space, I think, as more of a feeling that, you know, they kind of yearn for those very predictable days, and they feel that, you know, these very similar peoples have been split by what they consider to be artificial borders, if you like. So, yes, it's an issue. It will always be a big issue in Russian politics.
And this yearning for stability, I read somewhere that one party is playing on the idea of the Russian Orthodox Church being hugely influential in Russian politics now. This yearning of stability, does it actually harken back to a romantic ideal that the Russian people may still have?
Yes, I think it does. And I think, you know, there is this idea that this country is so vast that it's a challenge to govern. And of course, Russia's history has been incredibly bloody. You know, the revolution in 1917, obviously, Second World War, you know, Stalin, the purges and everything. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, there was a sense that, you know, now we have a chance to kind of usher in a period of stability. And under Putin, from 2000 to 2008, there was this incredible economic boom, and people really saw the, certainly in the cities anyway, saw that living standards rise. And people got used to that. And then when the economic crisis globally kind of kicked in 2008, 2009, that suddenly began to evaporate. And that's when the Kremlin began to have problems, these problems that we're talking about.
And looking ahead, tentative, shaky, difficult that these little steps may be to create new political parties. Is this the beginning of something that Putin may not be able to control? I mean, we've seen his position is weakened despite the fact that he's been returned to power. Could this mark the very, very, very beginning of a turning point in Russia?
It could, yes. I mean, I think it's obviously too early to say, but yes, it certainly could. Certainly, some people in the opposition, the anti-Kremlin opposition in Russia, very much hope that it does. They're aware, they know about the flaws in this, they know the danger of having too many parties or voters being confused, but still they think, well, you know, at least there is a choice. And the key thing here is that previously, to register a political party, it was incredibly difficult. You had to get 40,000 members, you had to prove that you had 40,000 members. Now it's 500, so it's a massive difference. So I guess time will tell, but it's not completely cynical move, if you like.
Andrew, I didn't just get you here to talk about Russian political parties. I think I'm going to spring a bit of a surprise on you. We'll move on to another subject that's sort of dominating the headlines in Russia, Pussy Riots. What's the latest with that? They're still in prison, aren't they?
They are, yes.
Oh, three of them, the feminist rockers.
Yeah,
for any of those who doesn't have multiple copies of their work. The feminist rockers, Pussy Riots, three of them are in jail, I understand. What's been happening with them?
Yes, these three women, they're all in their 20s. Two of them are young mothers. They're still in jail. You know, I would remind listeners that they first came to prominence, well, earlier this year, actually. They staged an impromptu concert on Red Square, and then they made even bigger headlines in February, 2 weeks before the presidential election. They stormed into the biggest cathedral in Moscow, Christ the Savior Cathedral, and they gave again this impromptu performance that was very rude about Vladimir Putin. This caused a massive uproar. They were jailed, and they've been charged with hooliganism. But incredibly, the authorities are pressing for them to be jailed for 7 years. It's a pretty hardcore sentence. But it has, the whole issue has kind of divided Russian society and split even believers within the Russian Orthodox Church.
That was Monocle contributor Andrew Osborne. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, Morocco enjoys a reputation as North Africa's most stable state and has appeared unaffected by the upheaval of the Arab Spring that has swept through many of its neighbours in recent months. With a constitutional monarchy that has retained popular support throughout some testing political and economic times, the country has looked like bucking the regional trend for change. But is it plausible that the appetite for revolution can be suppressed in Morocco? And what are the factors that could undermine the long-term security there? Joining us to explain more is Nora Fakim, freelance journalist and Monocle contributor in Rabat. Hello there, Nora.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for joining me. So just give us a bit of background in terms of how stable you think Morocco is at the moment.
Well, I mean, the 20th February movement, which was the movement behind the Arab Spring in Morocco, has has calmed down this year. I mean, they were the ones which started the Arab Spring last year and which made the king create the new constitution. But this year, there have been small protests in North Morocco, but they've been also clamped down by security forces. So it's as if people can't really protest, and it's the reason why it's been calm, really.
Okay, but what do you think people really think about that? Are there any signs, for instance, on social media sites such as Twitter? Can you see how people really feel despite the clampdown?
Well, of course, I mean, a few months ago, one of the famous rappers in Morocco, he was also a prominent member of the 20th February movement, he was jailed because of his lyrics, because he criticised the king. He said that the country is not democratic, and he's been jailed for a year. A few months ago, also, there was somebody who insulted the king and has been jailed for 3 years. So it's as if people can't openly express themselves. They want to, and if they criticise anything, they can be jailed. Also, a blogger was also jailed for him criticising the regime. Some say that the constitution was created to sort of calm down protesters, and maybe that's the case.
Okay, but yeah. Do you think that the monarchy have a huge role to play in the continuing stability, or, if you like, forced stability of the area?
I think it's not only the monarchy, it's also the makhzen, or let's say the entourage of the king, who have the biggest control of the country. They're the ones who sort of bring out the security forces to sort of clamp down on protesters. I mean, the king is very popular in Morocco as well. He has got a lot of supporters here, but those who don't support the king are not free to, or the regime, let's say, more the regime, they're not free to express that.
Okay, and in terms of looking ahead, do you think that there could be a bigger eruption still to come in Morocco, which will allow people that freedom that they obviously are demanding elsewhere in the region?
Well, the 20th February movement, as I said, has died out. It's finished now. In January, February this year, there were a lot of protesters in the north of Morocco, which is new, because before they never protested, and they're from a very poor area. So for the first time, they protested. Mm. But the security forces came hard on them, and they arrested many people. Many people were jailed. So I think for now, they're not signs of future eruption. And maybe the 20th February movement will pick up later if they find a new strategy.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed. That was Noura Fakim, freelance journalist and Monocle contributor in Rabat. You're listening to Midori House. Was Apple Pie Bed by Lawrence Arabia. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be discussing the latest news surrounding Euro 2012. But first, here's Roger Crisp with the news headlines.
Thanks, Emma. The US Supreme Court has made a historic ruling in favour of President Barack Obama's signature health care reform law. The result drew the expected rounds of cheers and criticism just minutes after the verdict was made public. The law represents the biggest revamp in 50 years to the $2.6 trillion US healthcare system. Eurozone leaders are meeting in Brussels today in a summit which could decide the future of the euro. Finland's Europe minister said that Europe should prepare to live in a state of crisis for the rest of the decade, but that a stronger and more resilient continent will eventually emerge. International calls for Turkey to show restraint after one of its military aircraft was shot down by Syria have gone unheeded. The Turkish government said that the attack would not go unpunished. Russia is reported to be supporting Kofi Annan's six-point peace plan for Syria, which will be discussed at a special meeting of the UN Action Group on Syria in Geneva on Saturday. Shares in Barclays Bank fell 15.5% today, their biggest one-day fall since 2009, as authorities prepared to investigate the bank's bosses. Barclays was fined £290 million by US and British authorities yesterday after investigations found that the bank had tried to manipulate key market interest rates. And French carmaker PSA Peugeot Citroën has launched its high-range DS line in China today, expecting growth in China to continue strongly. And those are the headlines here on Monocle 24.
It's 18:33 in London and 20:33 in Kiev. And that's where we're heading now to check in with our man there, Bruce Leuschman, ahead of today's semi-finals between Germany and Italy, and to get an overview of how Ukraine has dealt with Euro 2012. Good evening, Bruce.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining me. So how well prepared was Kiev?
Look, I think you'd have to say it was a bit of a rush to the finish for little old Kiev in the end. The new international airport, which has been built at great expense, especially for the year 2012, hasn't yet opened. They were saying it may open prior to the grand final, but I don't think that's going to happen now. But we've had a few other improvements. There have been some high-speed trains delivered by Hyundai, which arrived about a week before the commencement of the Games, and there was a real issue, of course, because the train tracks themselves were not compatible with the wagons when they tried to work them. So you'd have to say there's been a lot of hiccups along the way. But in the end, they did bring out a little team of ladies with brooms and spades, and have done a bit of beautification around the city.
Right. Okay, nice. But I mean, when I hear something like that about the airport, why didn't it materialise? Surely this was the prime opportunity for Kiev to transform its image and become a tourist hotspot.
Yeah, absolutely. You really have to question. And there's a number of major hotels around the city which were also being built for the Games, which just didn't make it in the end, including one which is active just exactly next to the stadium. So you really have to question, I think, the long-term planning. What we do know is that the organising committee on the Ukraine side was a bundle of disorganisation, and
right.
it really things were left to the very last moment when, from what I understand, Poland and with the UEFA officials really had to step in to at least get the stadiums ready.
How much investment do you think there's been in the area?
Well, what we're told about, there's been about $10 billion spent, okay? But largely, that's gone on these huge stadiums which are around the place and these airport terminals which have popped up, and some of them aren't opening. So you do have to kind of question, you know, what is going to be the long-term benefit of that, you know? And the question is, you know, has it been a bit of a missed opportunity for Ukraine on a number of levels? Not only, you know, just has it been able to present its most positive face out there, but is it really going to get any, you know, long-lasting benefit from, you know, the billions of dollars that have been spent? And I have to say, much of it, it's said, is unaccountable for.
So do you think, looking ahead, that there will be more people now open to going to the Ukraine, having held Euro 2012 there? I mean, is it something that's going to change people's minds?
You know, I think the sad thing is for Ukraine that if more people had come, I think people, when they do come to Ukraine, they quite like it. You know, it has some great cities, and it can be fun. So from what I gather, those people that have come have really enjoyed it. But the thing is, the very negative publicity which occurred in the lead up to Euro 2012, a lot of it self-induced, for example, regarding Timoshenko. But that really put off a lot of people. But from what I gather, and I've just been down to the fan zone today to have a look what was going on, And, you know, people are drinking beer and walking around and, you know, they seem more happy. I understand that day trips to Chernobyl are a huge hit with football fans. And also the shooting ranges where you can go and shoot an AK-47 or a Kalashnikov are doing huge business. So
that's nice.
It's all boys and toys in Ukraine at the moment.
Okay, and just a final question, really, on the obviously the fear about racism and those sorts of issues. How's the social side of it been?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, it's true that you know racism is a real issue, not only in Ukraine but all in all of Eastern Europe. What it has done, if anything, it has kind of brought the issue to the forefront of the Ukrainian media, and it's a very hotly discussed topic in Ukraine at the moment, which I think is a positive thing, and I think it's something that, you know, as a society needs to be considered. But of course, you know, Sweden played all their matches in Ukraine, in Kiev rather, and about 40,000 Swedes came to Kiev for a few weeks. So the city really was just a sea of sandy blonde boys. So I don't think there was much fear of racism in that.
Well, no, that's a fair point. Well, thank you very much indeed for that insight. That was Monocle's Bruce Leishman live from Kiev. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Nestled into the urban fabric of London, Hong Kong, New York and Tokyo, Monocle shops are small, cosy outposts of everything we care about. That's incredible design, credible provenance, charming service and, of course, intelligent journalism. Stock up on the latest issue of the magazine, browse our carefully curated selection of books and music, or seek out your favourite back issue to fill that gap in your Monocle archive. So, drop in to one of our shops and our friendly staff will be on hand to show you around. For addresses and opening hours, visit monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Barnett. Every day on Midori House, we ask one of Monocle's editors from the editorial floor to talk us through what's in their section of the current issue and what they've got coming up on their radio shows. It's Thursday today, which means design, which means Monocle's Hugo MacDonald is in the studio. And joining us on the line from Men's Fashion Week in Paris is Monocle's Aisha Spears. Welcome. So firstly, Hugo, tell me what's happening in this week's episode of Section D.
Well, Emma, throwing it forward to next Tuesday's episode, we are sort of taking our editors who've been in Milan and Paris and actually Florence before that for the men's collections. We're going to take them and ask them exactly what they found and give a bit of a rundown of the state of the industry. So I don't want to give too much away here today, but check in on Tuesday at 1900 hours for Section D to hear a lot more in-depth analysis of the latest men's collections. This is why I've got Aisha on the line, because she has actually spent much of last week in Milan and is now in Paris. Aisha, thank you very much for taking time out of your very, very busy schedule to join us.
No worries. I apologise if you get an authentic Parisian scooter sound going past, but I am standing in a street in Paris. So
I really hope we do, actually. But
I'll try and cue one up.
Yes, please.
I'll hit one for you.
Thank you. Like I said there, I don't want you to reveal too much in advance, but maybe it would be interesting for you just to say what is the difference between the Milan collections and the Paris collections, or the way that the cities kind of handle these two shows?
Well, I think firstly, I mean, there's a huge difference in what the cities are like themselves. So I think you can definitely feel that, whereas Milan very much feels like with their full fashion week and the whole city kind of well, in a sense, and it's something that you see obviously during Design Week there too, during Salone, if the city kind of turns itself inside out for the people who are visiting. Paris is just, you know, everyone's going on their daily business. There's literally a woman carrying a baguette in front of me, and I hope we do have a scooter. And, you know, around the corner there's a huge fashion show going on. So it's very much very different cities. And then the people who show here are very different. So obviously in Milan we've got more tailored brands, the older companies, people who are also doing textiles, people like Zegna, you've got Bottega Veneta, you have Gucci and Prada, whereas here in Paris there's shows from a lot of the big brands like Louis Vuitton and Hermès, of course, but then there's also a lot of trade shows. There's a trade show in Milan called White, which is slightly more, we often find one brand there that we really like, but not a huge number of brands, whereas here in Paris there's a huge selection of trade shows. So it's kind of a little bit more casual here, less three-piece suits, on the catwalk, and also in terms of people visiting the shows. Here people are happy to wear shorts and a T-shirt and kind of pop along to a show and then a trade show.
It's interesting that you started there by saying that in Milan it really, the whole city gets behind it. Do you feel that the sort of local people who aren't working in the fashion industry in Milan, they love the spectacle of the fashion weeks that sort of land, well, four times a year if you count men's and women's, whereas the Parisians turn their noses up a little bit and they don't really like the fact that there's some, sort of some disruption to maybe their daily lives?
I think so, and I think also with Milan, you know, it's known as the kind of centre of production for a lot of Italy's fashion and design industry. So even if people are not involved in it directly during that week, there's a lot of people involved in it in the periphery, whereas Paris is, yeah, just life goes on in Paris. But I think it is a different crowd of people. You have buyers here who won't be at Milan. You have buyers here from perhaps German stores who are more into streetwear or slightly more casual things, not so much the tailoring crowd that you get in Milan. So it's a slightly different story. But the interesting thing actually is that the way the calendar works, you have this weird shift. So there are a lot of buyers from the big department stores like Barneys and Bergdorf who are in Milan currently still and missing the first couple of days of Paris because they've got to have all their buying meetings. And this is the first year that we've seen the weekend of shows that we did in London. People after that went to Pitti and then Milan and then Paris. So it's a long trip for a lot of buyers. And the people who show at the beginning, like Raf Simons did last night here in Paris, perhaps may miss out on the important buyers who will still be in Milan.
How very interesting. Now, talking also about how you get around the cities, because, I mean, we were speaking when you were back briefly after Milan, before Paris, about just the nightmare of trying to navigate Milan when everybody is trying to get to the same place. And it was earlier on in the previous collections, you were stranded because there was a taxi strike, wasn't there? Is Paris easier to get around or less easy?
I find it much easier. The metro. I love the Paris metro, and I'm also quite a fan of the Philippe, the Boris bike equivalent here. So I'm happy to do that. It's very hot today, as it was in Milan. So the metro is a little bit tenuous. There you go. That was a scooter for you. I did take the metro back from the Louis Vuitton show to the Man show, which is one of the new trade shows, which I think we'll be talking about on Section D next week. And so, you know, I love the metro here. It's much easier. Milan's a lot trickier.
Actually, I just wanted to ask, what's the differences between the catering and how all of that works?
It's the same kind of thing. Well, actually, in the shows themselves, Italy comes number one. So you'll have a lovely espresso and a nice little croissant and like little snacks at the shows, whereas Paris is slightly more kind of get in, see the show and leave. Dries Van Noten is this evening and he often has a nice drink. But I think Paris is much more of a party city. I think people are here. You get a lot more hangers-on in Paris, in a sense. You get a lot more people who are here to either blog or to DJ at a party, not necessarily actually attend any of the shows. And even though this is Men's Week, not Women's Week, there is still a lot of buzz for the party scene around the city. So I think people are here, they are definitely kind of probably going to going out a little bit later and turning up a little bit more hungover at the shows the next day.
Talking of buzz, was that a scooter in the background I heard there?
Yeah, we've had two scooters, and that's quite a successful sound effect. Paris street sound effects.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed. That was Aisha Spears, about to party, I'm sure, in Paris. And I also want to say thank you very much to Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald.
Thank you.
You're listening to Midori House. Next up, we will be discussing Silicon Valley's bid to bring manufacturing back to America. But first, here's AM and Sean Lee with Somebody Like You. That was AM and Sean Lee with Somebody Like You. Now, just when you think all of the world's manufacturing has been moved to China, Google starts bucking the trend. The Nexus Q, Google's first major foray into designing and producing its own hardware in-house, will be manufactured inside the United States, not overseas. But what are the positive and negative aspects to this move? Joining me on the line to discuss it further is Monocle's San Francisco correspondent, Alistair G. Hello, Alistair.
Hi there. Good morning.
Hello. Yeah, good morning to you. Good evening to me. Now, what do you think the main reason behind this change or this sort of step change, really, for Google?
Well, I mean, for Google in particular, you know, it's a special case. I mean, the head of the business of the Nexus is describing this as an experiment. You know, all the business has been going to China in recent decades. You know, Apple has all those major manufacturing facilities with Foxconn. And so I think Google, you know, this is just a couple hundred jobs. So this is not sort of a massive game-changing move for Google. This is just a test for them. But in general, you know, more and more companies are coming back to the U.S., and there are sort of a couple of important reasons. One of them is that Chinese factory wages and benefits are increasing by 15 to 20% each year. So it's becoming less competitive. And also for many goods, when you take into account supply chain costs and things like the cost of industrial real estate, China actually may not turn out to be that much cheaper than some US states.
Okay. I mean, I understand that Google, in typical Google style, hasn't disclosed the location of this factory yet. Why do you think that is?
I actually have no idea. I mean, it's probably because, you know, they just like to control their media exposure, and they want you to know about things when they're good and ready. And plus, you know, it's an experiment. I mean, I think as the head of the Nexus program said, you know, we're trying to see if this works. And if this doesn't work, they don't think that they want their failure to be sort of widely publicised.
No, that is a fair point, and they have had a few recently. Do you think the rights of workers is also part of the thinking? Because, as you mentioned, Apple is having a bit of a nightmare with its manufacturing plant over there using Foxconn, and the human rights of the workers are absolutely dreadful by all accounts. So how much do you think that's feeding into this wider trend of companies bringing manufacturing back inside the United States?
I mean, that, you know, companies are definitely perceiving that to be, at the very least, a public relations issue. I mean, Tim Cook, the head of Apple earlier this year, vowed to, you know, shed more light on how Apple's workers were doing. You know, he made a conference call sort of where he's talking about Foxconn, which is something that Steve Jobs never did. So I think, you know, at the very least, executives are perceiving it to be an image problem, if nothing else. But also, you know, that there are perceived to be economic benefits, as I mentioned, with these wage increases in China. And it's also something that's very high on President Obama's sort of priorities. I mean, he said earlier this year that he doesn't want America to just be known for its debt. He wants it to be known for the words made in America. So it's not just a case of, you know, workers' rights. I mean, there's a very high level, in fact, efforts to make this into more than just, you know, a few forays. They want to make this into a big sort of trend in manufacturing.
But in terms of the sort of incentives that Obama's put on the table, are they very compelling for companies?
Well, it's hard to say, really. I mean, you know, with many of the companies, I mean, at the very least, you know, it wouldn't be Obama putting the benefits on the table. It would be individual states and what states can offer. I mean, you know, it was just announced that Airbus is planning to bring a factory to Alabama. And, you know, what Alabama can offer that other places can't are sort of non-unionized workers who are potentially cheaper than workers in Europe. I mean, that's not talking about China, but, you know, there are sort of individual benefits with regard to particular states. So, you know, I think in general, just with the economic, just with the recession, you know, states are taking a much more aggressive approach to offering tax benefits, creating these manufacturing zones where you don't pay certain duties and things. I mean, we've seen that in Alabama for certain. So I think states are taking a proactive approach.
Do you think this is going to be something that goes across Silicon Valley? There's been rumours for a long time, for instance, that Facebook might move into making its own mobile phone. Is it some way of having more control and something you see happening more and more?
Well, I mean, there have been... What's interesting with Facebook, for example, and Twitter in particular, is that these, like many of the new companies in Silicon Valley, aren't currently producing goods. You know, they're producing websites and services. So at least at the moment, many of these new companies don't really have anything to move onshore or offshore. Mm. It's hard to say what Facebook will do, but California has infamously high taxes, and it's infamously difficult to get permits to do things here. So that's, you know, part of the reason why many companies are not just moving to China, but talking about moving to other states like Colorado and Nevada, is that it's hard to build things in California for cheap. You know, there have been sort of reports saying that in general across the board, you know, 2 to 3 million jobs might come back from overseas to the U.S. by the end of the decade. So it sounds like, you know, at least in the eyes of some observers, this is something that's going to just pick up speed.
I think what other people have been probably thinking when they heard this announcement last night out of Google's HQ, obviously at their annual I.O. Developers Conference, is why not India? You know, why leave, you know, other cheaper countries potentially out of the mix?
Well, I mean, you know, that's certainly one option. I mean, you know, manufacturing might shift from China to countries with lower labour costs in China, like India, like Vietnam, like Mexico. But these countries don't necessarily have the right infrastructure or the enough skilled workers to produce higher-end goods like, say, an iPhone or a Google phone.
OK, well, no, that's all fair points indeed. But probably Google, we can assume at the moment, it's in that rare and enviable position not to have to care too much about costs and can do these lovely experiments to see if it can further its gains. So thank you very much indeed. That was Monocle's Alistair G. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much to our producer, Dawn Trump, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Ben Jay. Now, up after the news is this week's episode of The Urbanist. On today's show, Andrew Tuck will take a look at the bicycle culture around the world. Guy Delorney reports from Phnom Penh, a city whose residents have been a bit cautious to get out on two wheels. But a rash of new bike shops are helping to convince them. And Guy met up with two of them.
Among this group, there are people from many different social class categories. You know, there's some poor kids with some rich guy, and everybody talk friendly. And it's just, I think in the cycling people, I don't care. I mean, I'm the big guy, I have the money.
In 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours here in London, Chloe Potter and Ted Kravitz will be back for the Monocle Daily. Andrew Mueller will be back with Midori House at the same time here tomorrow. Thanks for listening to me, Emma Barnett. Goodbye.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Du lytter til Monocle 24.
Você está escutando Monocle 24.
Sie hören Monocle 24.
Acute Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.